thinking. Those are kind remarks. You know, it's really been a privilege for me to be a part of Jean's recovery in a sponsorship relation, and it's been a real privilege to see her grow and change in this program, and I've really enjoyed being with her too, and I think she's pretty priceless. Before I forget my manners, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come down and be the Al-Anon speaker at the first, roundup for Fellowship by the Lake. But more important, I'd like to thank the committee for including Al-Anon on their program for this weekend. I'm glad that they recognize alcoholism as a family illness, and that we whose lives have been deeply affected by alcoholism and a relative or a friend need a program of recovery too. I think sometimes you people in AA don't really understand that our program is for us. I think sometimes you think we're just up there talking about y'all. But you know, we have enough to work on ourselves without being concerned about y'all. We've spent too much time being concerned about you in the past. In the past. I'll settle down in a minute. Also want to thank the committee this morning, as Gina has told you, for their contribution to my humility and my honesty. You know, when Jean called and asked me if I would speak, my first comment was, oh no, I'm not a conference speaker. And I said, you know, you've got to be kidding, why me? And she didn't tell me what I thought she was going to tell me. She didn't tell me how great I was and so forth. She told me what she told you all. That because they didn't have any money, they had to find somebody from the local area that would come down here and talk and not incur any expenses for the committee. As far as my honesty is concerned, when I look out here, I see most of you. You Al-Anons particularly, who have sat around meeting tables with me, and shucks, y'all know my story probably better than I do. You could probably tell it better than I could. And if I don't get it right tonight, this morning, you're going to remind me about it later. So I got to tell it like it is. So I guess I can tell you I stand before you this morning with my humility and my honesty intact. My name is Alice O'Malley, and I am a deeply grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. My home group is the Beverly Hills Unity Al-Anon Family Group in Huntington, but I also attend the Wednesday morning group and the Thursday night Alateen group. I enjoy being with those kids. They're great. If you haven't been with them, try it. You'll find you get an awful lot of love and support and learn an awful about a lot about your program by being an Alateen sponsor. It takes a lot of meetings for me. It always has from the very start. When I first came into Al-Anon, we were in the Washington area at the time, and I was going to meetings as many as 5 and 6 meetings a week. Now, this was possible over there because with meetings in Maryland, D.C., and in Virginia, you know, there were meetings morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week. If you need the meeting, you don't have any problem finding one. I find now that I have reduced my meetings to maybe 3 a week, I feel like I've made some progress. But I do know that the quality of my serenity is in direct proportion to the quantity of meetings that I attend. When I find myself getting back into the old behavior patterns of, you know, being critical of people, being picky, getting out of sorts and so forth, trying to manage and direct, you know, being president of the universe again like I used to, I know that I've been missing meetings or I maybe need extra meetings. I say I am a member of Al-Anon because I do attend meetings. I try to live by the steps and adhere to the traditions and the concepts of the Al-Anon program. You know, Al-Anon is represented, our three legacies are represented by the triangle. And if I'm only working one side of that triangle, the side that we talk about the steps for recovery, and ignoring the other two sides, I've got a lopsided triangle. So in order to have a well-balanced life, I need to be applying all three legacies to my life. I guess what I'm supposed to do this morning is tell you what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. And that's not too difficult. I can do that. In fact, I can probably do it in about less than 10 seconds. It was pure hell. I found Al-Anon. And today, it's almost heaven. That's a fairly good time for a West Virginian. I don't live in a fantasy world anymore. I can face reality and live in the real world, and I know every day isn't going to always be heavenly. That really it's not what's happening in my life that's making it a heaven or hell, but it's my attitude toward it. They told me when I came into Al-Anon that I could be happy, but it didn't depend on other people. My happiness had to be an inside job. It had to start with me. It was a matter of maintaining positive attitudes. And I think today, really, that happiness is a byproduct of a positive attitude. So I don't look to everybody else like I used to. It was my husband's responsibility, my family's responsibility. Everybody had to make me happy. And I found today that that's not the case. It's up to me. They could stand on their head and wiggle their ears. And if I'd made up my mind I was going to be unhappy, they weren't going to change it. So I guess that's not really enough. Y'all not quite ready to leave yet. So I guess I better tell you what I used to be like and how I found Al-Anon and what my life is like today. Kind of the BA part. We'll start with that. That's before Al-Anon. I am a West Virginian. I was born and raised and spent the first 25 years of my life in Huntington. But you know, I remember being reminded frequently by my parents that I should never forget that my mother and father and my grandparents and their parents and their grandparents, probably generations back to Jamestown, were Virginians. I think that this may be what you call FFB snobbery. I never was really quite certain why it was important that I be reminded that my ancestors were descendants of the first families of Virginia. I wondered if they thought maybe that might keep me from being a total hillbilly. I never was real sure. About a year ago, I found the answer. Somebody gave me some cocktail napkins, and it says to be a Virginian, either by birth, marriage, adoption, or even on one's mother's side, is an introduction to any state in the Union, a passport to any foreign country, and a benediction from the Almighty God. It says anonymous, but I'm sure that anonymous person was a Virginian. My folks were, I looking back on it, were very much concerned with what you were. I think it was more important to them than it was to know who you were. I can remember every time I'd have a date with somebody new, my father would always say, "What's his dad do? Where do they live?" You know, the usual questions. If Daddy happened to know who his father was and so forth, that made him okay. Of course, he could have been, you know, just real ornery and horrible, but as long as Dad knew who they were, he was okay for me to go out with. I was an only child. I hated it. I was jealous of all you people that had brothers and sisters. I think that this was one of the reasons that I always wanted a lot of friends. I didn't like being alone. I never wanted to be just a one-friend person. I wanted a whole bunch of friends because I didn't have all those people at home. I don't think being an only child made me a pampered and made me spoiled, if you think of spoiled as being pampered and indulged. I was given a great deal of love and support and encouragement from my family. But I grew up during the Depression years, and where my father was always fortunate, he had always maintained a job, had a job, and we had a roof over our head and food on the table. But I'm sure my mother had to be a real good manager to stretch that monthly paycheck to cover all the basic necessities. There was not anything left over for luxury, believe me. And at this point, I really felt deprived because I didn't have a lot of the material things that a lot of my friends had, whose fathers apparently were a little better financial straits than mine. I think at one time or another, I thought we were going to go to the poor farm, you know, that life was just not going to be really anything that was ever going to be very financially secure for us. And also the fact being an only child, I forgot to mention that I used to spend a lot of time worrying about what would happen to me if anything happened to my mother and daddy. I had visions of having to go live in an orphanage, you know. I think probably both of these things, when I started taking my inventory and looking back, I found a lot of emotional insecurity, a lot of financial insecurity. These things were developing at a very early age, and I was to carry them into my marriage, whether there'd been alcohol in the marriage or not. So I think these things, you know, we blame it on the alcoholism, but when we really get honest and start looking back, they were already a part of our life before we got involved with the disease of alcoholism. I grew up in a good Christian home. I think we hear many people around the fellowship say this, and I sometimes wonder if that's a real good place to come from. First time probably I was ever taken out as an infant was when I was taken to Sunday school. My name was put on a cradle roll. My mother and father were very active and involved in church work, and it was just, you know, it was expected of me to be active involved too. I can remember that you got up and went to Sunday school and church on Sunday. If you didn't go, the only excuse for not going was if you were sick. And if you were too sick to go to Sunday school and church on Sunday morning, you were going to be too sick to do anything else the rest of the day, too. I think I believed in God. I never questioned that there was a God. He was. I knew that he was the creator of the universe. He hung the stars and the moon and so forth and made the world go around. But I don't remember ever really thinking too much about who God really was in relationship to me. He controlled everything out there, but I wasn't really conscious of the fact that he was close to me. I knew that he was a judgmental God. He had a lot of laws and rules and so forth that he handed down that you better obey, and because if you didn't, you were going to suffer the consequences. You'd be punished. I think that I had a God of fear rather than a God of love. I'd been in this program quite a while when I discovered that God didn't love me because I was good. He loved me because he was good. And I am very grateful to the Fellowship of Al-Anon for finding a God today that is a friend and somebody that I really feel like I can talk with and share with without a lot of these and thous and formal religious terms. I grew up in a mother-dominated home. My mother did this real subtly, you know, kind of the velvet glove approach. She didn't make a whole lot of noise and so forth, but she made the decisions and controlled everything that happened in our family. She was responsible for everything my dad did, everything that I did, probably even beyond that. You know, my daddy may have thought he ruled the roost, but my mother ruled the rooster. This was a role model that I was to carry into my marriage, you know. I think my feeling was that behind every successful man, there was a good woman. So, you know, man, I was going to have to learn to be a good woman because I wanted a successful husband when the time came. As far as physical appearance is concerned, I didn't like anything about the way I came into this world. I guess I really felt like I was the ugly duckling. Everything about me I wanted to change. I was tall and I was skinny. I'd like to have been short and plump. Well, not really plump, but a little more rounded. I had long, straight, brown hair when it would have been a lot more fun to be a blonde and have curls. You know, there just wasn't anything about me that I thought was a redeeming feature. And Mother didn't help matters much because she used to tell me, pretty is pretty does. And I thought, well, that's interesting, but she thinks I'm not pretty too. So I'm going to have to learn how to be pretty, how to act pretty. Because in my mind at that time, I felt that if people liked me, if I was going to be popular and have friends, that if I didn't attract them because of my beauty, my looks, I was going to have to find some way to make them like me as a person. And if I could do what I thought you wanted me to do, or what you told me you wanted me to do, then you'd like me and be my friend. But worse still, if I did what I thought you wanted me to do, that was even better. But, you know, that backfired a lot of times, because a lot of times I'd do things that I thought you wanted me to do, and you didn't have the remotest idea that I was doing them because I thought you wanted me to do them, and I didn't get the pats or the approval and so forth. And, boy, that leaves you frustrated. You know, you get kind of angry and resentful. But I think this was the beginning of a lot of people-pleasing in my life. I felt that I had to be all things to all people in order to be able to have friends. My school years, I guess, were pretty normal years. I don't remember anything too outstanding. I think probably I was, by today's standard, an overachiever. It was very important for me to maintain a good grade point average because, you know, this got me recognition. This got me approval. There were probably some normal traumas that all of us go through. I can remember being devastated because I didn't get a bid to the most prestigious sorority when I was in high school and had to settle for second best. That was kind of bad. Oh, and it was really bad because I ended up feeling like a wallflower because I didn't have a date for the junior prom. But I made sure that the senior prom was going to be different. I started taking care of that early. And I invited a college man. At that point, you know, being tall, high school boys were still a little bit shorter. And these college guys had a chance to grow a little bit, you know. So I felt that they were more mature and so forth. So I took care of the senior prom. That was fine. I think by the time I did graduate from high school, I had a reasonably good attitude about life. I felt like that I was going to be able to handle whatever life had to hand, and that I'd be okay. And I was looking forward to going to college in the fall. I met Jean my sophomore year in college, thanks to the Army Air Corps. You know, Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor my senior year in high school, and my freshman year in high school, the beginning of the freshman year, men were starting to kind of trickle off campus. And by my sophomore year, believe me, men were a rare commodity. The only thing left on campus, male, were 4Fs. And for those of you who may not know, some of you younger people, those are ones who aren't physically fit for military duty. Or those who were overage, you know, too old to be in service. So, you know, that didn't do a whole lot for our social life. So Marshall at this time was designated as a college training detachment for Air Force cadets. They brought squadrons of Air Force cadets on campus on a regular basis, and they'd be there for a four-month tour. And believe me, folks, that was an answer to the maiden's prayers. You know, you couldn't fraternize too well with these cadets because they marched in to and from classes in formation. They had their own dining hall, and they had their own PX. I tried to get a job in the PX, but other people were smarter. They had applied earlier, so I didn't get that opportunity. But, you know, there are always ways to make contact with people if the determination is there. Most of the cadet classes were in the science hall, and you'd be amazed at how many people enrolled for courses in chemistry and geology and botany and so forth, because those courses were held in the science hall too. And, you know, between breaks, you could always strike up a conversation with somebody, you know, standing in the hall before you went into class. There were always ways that you could meet these guys. Of course, they had open post on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Oh, and they had Tuesday night USO dances on campus. And, of course, the Huntington girls were only too happy to do their patriotic duty and go out and, you know, circulate and be friends with these poor boys that were away from home, you know, and make them feel welcome and not be so lonesome. I met Gene on his first open post. He says I picked him up. I choose to think that it was kind of a mutual thing. Walgreens at that time was known as the place where the co-eds went to look over the new crop of cadets and where the cadets went to look over the co-eds. And this was on a cold, snowy January night. I had had something to do at the sorority house that night, and about four of us decided, well, we were already downtown. We'd just go down to Walgreens. We knew there had been a new group of cadets that had come in, and they'd be showing up. And we were sitting there having a Coke, and a group of about four or five cadets walked in, and there was one that was tall and blonde and had blue eyes, and I thought, He really looked attractive. And of course, they came over and we got acquainted, and we all sat there and talked for quite a while. Ended up out at my house that night, would you believe, going sleigh riding. And my mother, bless her heart, made hot chocolate chip cookies and hot cocoa. You know, for a long time, I wondered whether Gene was coming to see me or whether he was coming out to see my mother, because she made good chocolate chip cookies. But this was the beginning of a real good romance. We were fortunate. We had 6 weeks longer than the 4 months, because Gene got caught in the squadron that when the pre-flight program that they were going on to from this college training detachment was overloaded and kind of backlogged. So instead of sending them to pre-flight, to sit down in pre-flight until they had room for them to go through the program. They kept them at Marshall. And this was great. We had an extra 6 weeks. We ran with a fun crowd, and there was drinking. But, you know, drinking was never a problem for me. My family drank. My daddy kept a bottle of gin and a bottle of bourbon under the kitchen sink. And when we had company or on holidays, he'd fix the ladies probably a Tom Collins, I guess. And he and the guys would gather in the kitchen and have bourbon and water or whatever men drink in the kitchen. But it was strictly sociable. You know, nobody ever got drunk. I was never really threatened by alcohol. So, you know, it didn't bother me. You know, Gene could drink a lot. And when he drank, though, he was fun. He, you know, man, he was a whiz on the dance floor after a couple of drinks, and he could tell better stories and jokes, and shit, he was the life of the party when he was having a few drinks. And, you know, I was a little bit jealous, because booze never did that for me. I never got that, whatever y'all call it, the glow. I went from being stone sober to either being sick or passing out. And, you know, I just never really understood how people got to that point where they had fun drinking. I learned early on to nurse a couple of beers through the evening. You know, I would have just seemed to have a Coke, but, you know, well, people might think I was a prude. So I'd nurse a couple of beers, maybe even one bottle of beer. I think at one time I even thought about pouring a Coke in a beer bottle so they would think I was drinking beer. I was kind of a party pooper because I was always ready to break up the party and go have, you know, a hamburger, a piece of chocolate pie at the Whirligig. Those of you who remember the old Whirligig, or go someplace and have breakfast. Everybody else, you know, kind of looked at me like, so early? But, you know, I was ready to do something besides just watch them get drunk. This was great. We had us a real fine time, and when it came time for Gene to leave, we continued our courtship through correspondence. You learn an awful lot about people through letters. He was a good letter writer, too. You know, you used to be able to write free on your envelopes when you were in service and didn't cost you even a stamp in those days. So he wrote lots of letters. He got home on leave a couple of times, and when he graduated from flying school, his parents invited me to drive out to Enid, Oklahoma for his graduation, and I got to pin his wings on him. And boy, he did look good, people. I'll tell you, that Air Force uniform back in those days was really sharp. You know, that floppy hat that they wear and so forth. He looked good. We talked about getting married. We talked real seriously about getting married at that point, but I still had one more year of college, and, you know, I'm kind of practical. I think my mother had threatened me within an inch of my life if I made that decision while I was out there, that she'd already seen me through 3 years, that I need to finish that fourth year. But we had dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, or Hiroshima, whichever way they say it now. And it did look like the war was going to be winding down, and he was going to be a civilian again soon. So it seemed practical that we kind of hold off and wait and see what happened. When Gene was discharged, he did come back to Morgantown. He was from Morgantown and started in the university. And, you know, I think drinking may have been starting to cause a few problems in his life about this time. He was flunking out of engineering school. You know, I made all the excuses, oh, it's the adjustment to civilian life, living back at home after being on your own, and so forth. But, you know, he was to make, at that point, the first geographical cure before we knew what a geographical cure was. He transferred down to Marshall. Now, this was great. I thought this was fine. All he needed was to be down here with me, and that'd take care of everything. You know, he wouldn't need the drink. He'd be so happy. Well, we got right back into our dating, and he was out in my house, and we were doing something every week. And really, this was interfering with his trying to study. He was working part-time, too, to help support himself along with the help of the GI Bill. So we decided, well, we might as well go ahead and get married. We were in love. We'd go ahead and get married. So we did. And he was going to get a matrimonial degree. I was through school by then, you see, and I'd help support him in getting through school. And about this time, people, I think I had written our life plan. Oh, forgot to tell you, you know, in this marriage, you know, we were going to be the perfect couple. He was going to make me happy, and I was going to fix all these faults. That was first. We were happy, but we were poor. We were awfully busy. We didn't really have time for, you know, a lot of the boozing and the party and so forth. So that really didn't really create too many problems at that point. But this life plan, I think I wrote the script. And this script was that he was going to finish school and get a job, and I'd quit work, have a family. We'd build that little cottage with a white picket fence in Huntington, join the country club, and live happily ever after. You know, this all sounded real good, and things were progressing real well. He did finish school. We jumped the gun a little. I got pregnant before he finished school. And a graduation present for him was our first daughter. And he had gotten a job. And everything looked like it was going along according to plan. But somebody wrote a page or a little postscript in that script of mine that I didn't know anything about. Come September, there came a letter from the Department of Defense saying that because of Korea, they needed his services again. This was not in my plan. This was upsetting everything. We were just getting to the point of where things were working out. How dare them? You know, I screamed and yelled and threatened to write the president and everything, but you know, Gene was delighted. He was thrilled to death. Not real sure whether it was the fact that he thought he was going to get to fly again or whether he just thought, this is going to get me back to where I can have a good time. Anyhow, I realized when I'm defeated, so I started packing and talked myself into, this wasn't going to be too bad. Korea couldn't last forever. And we were being sent to, our first duty station was going to be in Florida. And it'd be kind of nice to spend the winter in Florida. And, I thought, when he finishes, you know, the tour, we'll come back and pick up our life. And we did. We got down there, and Gene was assigned to the headquarters squadron in the command, Air Proving Ground Command. And we were the junior members of the outfit. And gosh, they just adopted us. They just made us feel so welcome and included us in everything. And there were a lot of parties and so forth. And we just enjoyed it. I thought, this isn't too bad. You know, I think I'm going to be able to enjoy this. But you know, Gene, at this point, decided that he was going to, since they had interrupted his life, that he was going to apply for a regular commission. And I thought, maybe he won't make it. But he did. He was accepted as a regular officer. And this kind of fitted in with my insecurities. It, you know, being a regular officer, we had a lot more security. If he, you know, did what he was supposed to and so forth, we could stay in the service until retirement. And you get to retire early in the service. And everything would be just fine. I knew what was going to happen in our life. A lot of these parties, when he did make regular, I decided that I needed to get real involved in all the Air Force activities for wives because, you see, I was going to make sure that I did everything possible to help him have a real successful career, going back to that business, you know, about wife being responsible. So, even with Gene being a second lieutenant at that time, I think I was entertaining visions of how nice it was going to be a colonel's lady. So, I did everything I could. I was going to help him get there by hook or by crook. But we were going to a lot of parties. And, you know, the things that used to be fun weren't fun anymore. When he'd get drunk and do all these crazy things at parties and so forth, I was embarrassed. I didn't think they were funny anymore. And I didn't understand how he could get drunk so fast. You know, I knew that while we were getting dressed, he'd say, why don't we have a drink while we're getting dressed? And he'd fix a drink and bring it up to me. I didn't realize that while he was fixing my drink in the kitchen, he was belting down three or four, you know, and to my one. And by the time we got there, he was well on his way anyway. But these were all things that I think were creating the storm clouds in our life. There was time, and there was money, and there was opportunity now to drink. He was going by the officers' club before he came home after work. And some nights, he was coming home late for dinner. And some nights, he was coming home very late and very drunk. And, you know, this wasn't what I had in mind, that this was not going to be good for our family life, and it was going to jeopardize his career. And he used to get long lectures on the error of his ways. And, you know, Gene may have prayed for the silent treatment, but he never got it. I was always very verbal. When he got to the point of where he'd pass out on me, and didn't know what I was saying. I'd write him long letters and prop them up on the breakfast table. Some of y'all have done that too, I hear. Honestly, this was, I guess, what you would call the beginning of 25 years of the war on alcoholism, and the home was the battleground, and I don't have to tell you who lost the war. I think it's kind of like Bob L. from California said at the International in Montreal, that alcoholism is a neurotic compulsion to control the drinking of a person who has a neurotic compulsion to drink. And that's where I was. I was trying to control something that he had a compulsion to drink. I mean, it was a mess. It didn't work anyway. I think by the time I got to the Al-Anon program, I qualified people. I was overly qualified. I was bankrupt. I was washed out, wiped out, whatever you want to call, in all three areas of my life, mentally, physically, and spiritually. Physically, you know, I had all the aches and pains, the tension headaches, you know, thought I had an ulcer. I used to throw up every night about time for him to come home from work and so forth. I found a description in an old Al-Anon pamphlet that is no longer on our literature list, and I think it's a shame. I think this should be in something. It talks about, sums up how an alcoholic wife is when she finally gets to the program of Al-Anon. It says, when the wife of an alcoholic first comes to Al-Anon, she has headaches because she can't figure things out. Heart spasms because her heart is in her mouth from fear. Nausea because she's fed up. Backaches because she can't bear it. Foot trouble because she can't stand it. And bladder and kidney trouble because she can't let go. I think that says it pretty graphically. Spiritually, I was all out of kilter too. You know, I did believe in God, and I'd been praying. I'd been telling God just exactly what I wanted him to do about this situation. I'd been telling him that he had to keep him sober. And you know, God wasn't doing what I was telling him to do. I bargained with him. I said, you know, oh, God, if you'll keep him sober this weekend while my folks are down visiting, I'll go to circle meeting every month for a whole year. You know, you just don't bargain with God that way. I really and truly was wondering about God, because I had always been told that God didn't give you more than you could bear. But I figured he had the wrong person. He'd made a mistake. People, I had all I could handle and more. So really, I kind of thought, well, God, if you're not going to take charge of this, I'm just going to have to forget you. I'm just going to have to do this all on my own. I've been trying to do it on my own anyway. Emotionally, God, I was crazy. There's just no other word. I was plumb crazy. I had rational reasons for doing a lot of things that I did, and I can tell you, sit here and tell you all day some of the idiotic, dumb things that I did that made sense to me, but just so I can identify, I'll share with you a couple. You know, we played all the games, the hide-and-seek. He'd hide the bottles, and the girls and I would go seeking and so forth, but he was smarter than we were. We didn't find them very often. I marked the bottles. You know how you put a little nick or a pencil mark on the label so you can tell how much he drank the night after he went to bed and so forth. But, you know, he discovered that, and he got pretty irate. I figured I couldn't get away with that anymore, but I figured out a new way to do it. You turn the bottle upside down, and you put a mark on it, and when you turn the bottle back up, that mark doesn't relate to anything. Drove him crazy. He didn't know what was happening. I used to threaten to leave regularly, but I never left because the washing wasn't done. I always had an excuse. Jane did a lot of drinking at the bar because I raised so much hell, you know, he couldn't drink too comfortably at home. And when he sat at the bar and drank, he played a lot of liar's dice. I don't know whether y'all know, but he always came home with pockets full of change, silver. Now, after he'd pass out, after he'd go to bed and pass out, I'd go through his pockets and I'd take all the silver. I'd leave the pennies and the nickels and so forth, but I'd get the quarters and the dimes and the 50-cent pieces. They had 50-cent pieces back then. And I'd put them in mayonnaise jars and hide them down in my lingerie drawer. And when I'd get a full jar, I'd go to the bank and I'd buy a bond. One month I'd put the bond in one girl's name, and the next month I'd put it in the next girl's name. You see, I could hide it this way. If you put it in savings accounts or something, he'd find out about it income tax. But as long as they were in bonds, you know, as long as I didn't cash them, I was protected. You know, I never touched the folding money, though. That was stealing. But the truth of the matter is, he had a hell of a lot more in silver than he had in folder money by the time he got home. Our family did eat a lot of mayonnaise. Gene drank everything, but he ended up bringing home Bourbon Supreme in those big jugs, you know. And I wasn't going to pour it out. I was too scotch to pour it out. So I'd pour it into mayonnaise jars and stash them all over the house, hide them. And my reason for doing this was that every year at Christmas time, I made fruitcakes. And I was going to need some of that booze to moisten and season the fruitcakes. People, I was nuttier than the fruitcakes. I'd have been having to make fruitcakes for the next 300 years to use up the amount of bourbon that I had hidden all over the house. You know, the vodka that he drank, you know, I couldn't figure anything to do with vodka. He quit drinking gin. It was vodka. You know, you can't smell vodka. Baloney. It comes out your pores and your t-shirts turn green, you know. But anyhow, he was convinced that he could drink the vodka. So I had to figure out something to do with the vodka. I had to get rid of some of that, too. And somebody at that point had given us two real pretty antique crystal decanters that I kept up on a hutch. So I poured the vodka in the decanters and put food coloring in it to match the decor of the dining room. You know, he didn't know it was vodka then. And it was very decorative. I think one of the worst things that I probably did was when we got ready to rotate and come back from a tour in Hawaii. You know, the Air Force normally transfers families in the summertime because that's a good time to find a house and get the kids enrolled in school and so forth and be settled for the fall term. But when Gene came from Vietnam to Hawaii, it was in November, so our rotation date was late. The big crunch had already gone through, and we could have come home surface transportation. We could have come across the Pacific on a five-day cruise on the Lurline. Sheer luxury. But oh no, we couldn't do that. Mary Kay was just in the third grade and she couldn't be out of school that long. Excuses? You know, the reason we couldn't come home on the Lurline was because they had too many bars on that boat and he'd be drunk all the time and I'd be miserable. So we flew home and he was drunk all the way across the Pacific. He made friends with the stewardess, but you know, it didn't take us long. For 20 years, people, this was the type of behavior that was going on in our home. I got to the point of where I was utterly defeated. I just, you know, I was just filled with the anger, the resentment, the apprehension, the anxiety, plain fear. And God, I hurt. The aching feeling that you get from not being able to stop something so drastic and so deadly in your life. You know, I loved him. I didn't want to leave him. I can remember him telling me many times, honey, you don't understand. And no, I didn't understand, but neither did he understand what was happening. I used to tell my girls regularly that Daddy was sick, and they bought it. You know, when Daddy was drunk, Daddy acted different than when Daddy was sober. And intellectually, up here in my head, I could say alcoholism was a disease, but down deep in my heart, down in my gut where it really counted, I thought if he loved us, he'd do something about it. I just did not know what I was going to do. It was a bleak January day, and I was sitting in my kitchen, and I simply couldn't make a decision as to whether to put dishes in the dishwasher, go upstairs and make beds, or whether to sit there and cry for another hour. And I think at that point, I hit my bottom, and I asked God, please help me. Not him. I'd been praying for him for a long time. But this particular morning, I surrendered and said, God, help me. And I think it was divine guidance and nothing else, because at that moment, I suddenly remembered that probably months back, I had read an article in an Ann Landers column that talked about some type of a group that provided help for children who live with alcoholic parents. And I thought, well, gosh, if there's help for children, there must be some kind of help for wives. And you had something to do with AA. But I really did not know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, or Alateen. When we were in Hawaii, we had had Gene had had some real unfortunate incidents occur. He had, one of them was he had had an accident on base, drunk. He'd run into the back of a car. He always ran into the back of cars, you know. He never ran into them head on. Oh, he did once, but he usually... I forgot that one, Gene. You know, it's one our insurance was never canceled. I'm going to get all mixed up. I'm going to digress a minute. We had USAA insurance. I don't know whether any of you are more military people, but that is officers' insurance in the military, and you can continue to carry it. And after we'd come into the program, there was a lady here in the Beverly Hills group who was from San Antonio. That's where the home offices are. And she was talking about, no, she wasn't from San Antonio. She went to visit in San Antonio, and she said she looked up. She was already in the Fellowship of AA, and she looked up on this corner at this huge building and said, say, USAA. And she said, my God, there's our national headquarters. But anyhow, Gene had had some problems, and one of the punishments for his being drunk on base and having an accident was his license was lifted. He could not drive on base. This wasn't too bad. I got him a bicycle. And he used to pedal back and forth. He was working at the command headquarters there at Hickam in the command center. And we were living on base. And he'd ride his bicycle back and forth. And he used to ride by the house, the lanai, or that faced the street, right past the house up to the officers' club. And I'd raised a little bit of hell about this. And he told me, he says, honey, he said, if you just drink with me, I wouldn't have to go to the officers' club. And I thought, okay. He said, why don't we start having martinis in the evening when I come home from work? And I thought, well, that's worth a try. So I'd make the martinis and put them in the freezer to chill. And I thought, this is going to be great. And I happened to look out the back door. And here he goes pedaling past the door right to the officers' club. And about 30 minutes later, he comes back. Well, are the martinis ready? He'd been up and had a couple of drinks before he came home to have martinis with me. Huh. You know, forget that. You know, deal's a deal. If he's going to come home, fine, and have drinks. But if he's going to go have them elsewhere, you know, we're just not going to have the martinis at home. When I had this thought about Al-Anon or Alateen or whatever it was, I reached for the phone, and I called Washington Intergroup, and of course, I use the standard, you know, approach. My husband has a drinking problem. What can you people tell me to help him get over it? And very patiently, she said, well, if you'll just wait just a little while, we'll have somebody return your call. And she did. Thank goodness. I was desperate. I didn't have to wait but just a few minutes, and this real nice lady called, and we talked for about an hour probably, and, you know, I don't remember a whole lot of what she said. But there were a couple things that did stick in my mind that made a real impression. And one of them, the biggest one, was that she said her husband had been just like mine. He'd been drinking for years. He'd been in service and so forth. But he had been sober for 7 years when they both were in Al-Anon and AA. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's a miracle. You know, that's an eternity, 7 years. At that point, I'd have settled for 7 months. She also told me that I had to learn not to react. I didn't know how not to react. He acted and I reacted. I asked her, I said, well, how do you do this? And she said, well, she said, I think if you come to some Al-Anon meetings, maybe you can find out some of these things. And I thought, I'm not really sure he's that bad. You know, it's kind of like being a little bit pregnant. Either you are or you aren't. You're not a little bit alcoholic. And I told her, I'd have to think about that. I just wasn't sure that he had top security clearances and so forth. People, he was working at the National Security Agency in Washington at the time as an Air Force liaison officer. So, you know, it was pretty important that his security clearance. In other words, anybody with the type of clearance that Gene had, if anybody in their family wasn't emotionally, God knows what I'm saying, secure and so forth and stable, that I could be a liability to the Air Force. My God, here he is out drinking every night at bars, probably giving away all the secrets of the Air Force, and I'm the liability factor? You know, the doctor, I think, puts up with, I guess alcoholism maybe isn't too new to the Air Force. There are probably a lot of wives that go through this. And you know what they did? They handed me a bottle of Valium and said, there's another one that's struggling. And I guess God was with me because those Valiums, you know, this never really did anything for me. I think I had the prescription that they gave me the first time when we finally retired. And that's a blessing too, because I could have very easily become hooked on them. But anyhow, getting back to my conversation, this real nice lady, when she saw that she wasn't going to talk me into going to a meeting right away, she said, well, how would it be if I sent you some Al-Anon literature? She assured me that it would come in a plain white envelope. And I said, oh, well, that'd just be fine. So it did, she did, and it came, and I read it and tried to digest and so forth. But, you know, with a confused mind like you have at my stage, you know, you don't really understand these things too well. So it was to take another 3 months before we had another crisis in our life, and I decided that if I was going to stay until school was out, this was along in March by then, if I was going to stay until Mary Kay finished school, you know, the laundry was no longer a problem, you know. I was just going to have to leave, but I was going to have something to be able to cope with this situation and stay until school was out. So I finally decided that maybe I needed to get to a meeting. And I called, and I met a lady, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. I remember telling Jean that I was going, because I don't lie very well. I give it away every time. And I told him that I was going to this meeting, and she had told me, I asked her about this, and she said, be sure and tell him that you're going for you. You're not going for him. And I thought, heck, I'm not. I'm going out to find out how to get him sober. But I did tell him this. Boy, he was pretty upset about it. He says, well, if you go, you be sure and not tell those people who you are. Don't you let them know what your name is. I said, oh, very well. I didn't know anything about the anonymity anyway. But I did go to that first meeting, and I was a little bit surprised because they did talk about this being a program for me. And I thought, you know, that's really crazy. If he'd just get his act straightened up, everything would just be fine in our life. You know, I knew he was sick and he needed help, but me, I was just fine. I was taking care of everything and coping with everything. If it hadn't been for me, the family would have been down the drain. But, you know, there was something there in that meeting. I felt something. There was a warmth, a love, an understanding. It was just, I guess the only thing I can say, it was a feeling of hope. That maybe they had some answers, that if I kept coming back, maybe I would find some answers to my problem. And I did continue to go. I think I was willing. At that point, I was willing to do almost anything they told me to do. If they told me to go down and jump in the Potomac River, I'd probably have headed for the bank. But they didn't tell me to do that. They told me to go to meetings. They told me to read the literature. They told me to get a sponsor and user. And they told me to keep my mouth shut and mind my own business. And that was tall order, you know. I hadn't been doing too much of that. But I was trying. I was beginning to learn a little bit about detachment. I was trying to get the focus off of him. They told me, you know, be good to me. To do some things that gave me some pleasure. Not to feel like I was a prisoner behind the drawn draperies in my house. That if he didn't feel like doing something, to take Mary Kay and go on out and do it. And I started doing some of these things. I remember that our oldest daughter had a new boyfriend, and she called from school and was talking about him. I said, honey, would you like to bring him home for the weekend? She said, what? You know, we didn't bring people home. I didn't let the kids bring anybody home. Dad might be drunk, and, you know, we didn't want anybody to know. I thought, yeah, all the neighbors fooled. But she said, great. So she did. They got home on Friday afternoon, and I planned a nice dinner, and dinner time rolled around. Dad didn't show up. You know, you'd expect him, his first daughter, you'd expect he'd be there, so glad to see her. But I didn't make everybody wait until 12 o'clock to eat dinner. We ate dinner at a reasonable time and had an enjoyable dinner and put the leftovers in the oven, and when he staggered in, he had his dinner. Nobody made a big deal out of it and so forth. Next day, Patty told me, she said, Mother, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what you're doing, but something sure better. Keep it up. Both of our girls have been very supportive of our involvement in AA and Al-Anon. Our younger daughter was an Alateener. Patty, the older daughter, never really has been involved in the program, but I think she's absorbed an awful lot of it by osmosis. I hear an awful lot of our Al-Anon program coming out of her at different times. You know, I started to get better. Our situation at home started to get better, and Jean was getting worse. You know, this was, you know, he objected at first when I started going to Al-Anon, but later he said, this is great. I was off his back. I wasn't getting up out of bed at night when he came in and greeting with my hands on my hips from the stairs to tell him he was drunk. You know, he knew he was drunk. I remember calling my sponsor about this time and saying, is this I don't think this is working. He's coming home later and drunker. She said, great, good. Oh, lady, you don't know what you're saying. But yes, she did. She knew that he had to reach some sort of a crisis or get into some kind of trouble where he recognized his drinking was a problem, where he hurt bad enough and long enough to want to do something about it. And this was going to happen, and then it wasn't going to take too long. He was involved in a crisis that I was a part of, but I didn't create. I had heard in Al-Anon that you didn't create a crisis, but you didn't prevent one from happening if it was in the normal course of events. I had taken a part-time job. My motives were a little bit cloudy. I was doing some office work up in one of the local department stores in the shopping center in Laurel, and I went to work at 5 o'clock at night and worked till 9. Now, this, you know, meant that when he got off work, he had to hurry home so he could babysit for Mary Kay. I'd have dinner all ready and so forth, and I'd be ready to go out the door as he walked in. This got him home faster, and he didn't have time to stop at the bars and so forth. He had to come straight home. Well, it worked for a while, but this one particular evening, he didn't get home, and it had been one of those god-awful days where everything goes wrong. The dog had run off. Mary Kay had come home from brownie meeting and fallen in a mud puddle and ruined a new pair of tennis shoes. You know, just one of those days where nothing went right, and he didn't show up, and I had to go across the street and make arrangements with people across the street for her to stay over there until he got home. And, you know, you're being so cagey about, you know, why he's delayed. You're making excuses. He's probably having to work late. And, you know, they know he's drunk, but you're trying to cover up. You don't think they know. Anyhow, I went on to work. Mad. Oh, God, I was mad. Called home periodically every 15 or 20 minutes, and when I finally got him, he answered the phone. Oh, I could tell he was. You know, we can tell when you're drunk on the phone. It's just something about the way you try to be so precise and the way you say your words and so forth. And I thought, this does it. I just thought I had had all I could take. My sponsor told me, she said, you know, don't make a decision to leave until you're sure you can walk away and not look back. And I really thought at that point, I was mad. I thought, I'm through. I can walk away. This was the 1st of June. School was, I think, be out in 3 or 4 days. I'm just going to leave. He can take care of himself. I'm not going to fight it any longer. So I walked in when I got off from work that night, and I walked through the house. He was doing something in the kitchen. He was puttering. I figured he probably was fixing a drink. And I went upstairs and grabbed a suitcase, threw a few clothes in it, and went in, awakened Mary Kay, and said, come on, honey, we're going. She said, where are we going? I said, we're going over to your Aunt Mary's in Bethesda. And she's crying and so forth, and I threw those suitcases in the car and gunned that car out of the driveway. And when I finally hit the beltway and was starting around, I started listening to what this poor child was trying to tell me, and she said, Mother, you don't know what you're doing. Said, Daddy has planned a surprise anniversary party for you tomorrow. The next day was our 25th wedding anniversary. He has invited 50 people, and he's having it catered, and he's been busy tonight polishing silver and trying to get everything ready. I thought, oh, what have I done? I had too daggone much pride to turn around and go back then. So I went on over to my aunt's, and I thought, he'll call. He'll call and ask me to come back. Phone didn't ring. So the next morning, I thought, well, you know, I've got to do something. All those people can't come to a party and the bride of 25 years not be there. So I went back home, and I walked in, and he's standing there in the kitchen trying to get a uniform on. He was so drunk, he could hardly stand up. You know, what does a good alcoholic do when you run into a situation like that? That's a desperate situation. So obviously, he'd been drinking all night. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to go to work. I said, like that? With that, I gave him a push, and he landed in the chair. We did some talking, and of course, first he blamed me. He said, you've really done it this time. You've really fixed it. It was all my fault. But the more we talked, the more he started crying, and he decided that maybe he did need to talk to those going AA. You know, he knew now, because I was going to Al-Anon, that there was some help. He'd met some of my friends from Al-Anon and some of their husbands, and you know, he needed help, and he needed to write that day. He needed somehow to get through that day and night. So we did get somebody to come down and talk with him that afternoon, and he made arrangements to go to his first AA meeting the next day. One of his good friends at the agency came down and talked to us and said, Gene probably had lost his job, but I didn't know this before, but I think he'd been getting some pretty severe warnings about his drinking, you know, those martini lunches and so forth. But just, that's his story. But anyway, Jack told us, he said, he may have blown it as far as work's concerned, but he said, I'll help you get through tonight. He said, we'll go out for dinner with you all. We were supposed to go out to dinner, come back and see if I find all these people there and be surprised, you know. So we did, and we came back, and we got through the night. How, I don't know, people, but I had pictures to prove that we were there. And he did go to his AA meeting, first AA meeting the next day. And I thought, this is going to be great, you know. Everything's going to be perfect now. He's going to AA, and I'm going down on. But, you know, he was going to meetings, but he was still getting drunk. And I got real resentful. You know, I had gotten him to you people, and you all weren't keeping him sober. You know, what's wrong with you? Anyhow, Gene did, he was relieved of his job with the National Security Agency. But, you know, the luck of an alcoholic, you know, fall in a shit house and come out smelling like a rose. They made him squadron commander of the Air Force detachment at Fort Meade. Well, it was fortunate. I think they realized that he only had several more months, and he had already put his papers in for retirement. And thank God, that very loving God did not make us lose our military retirement. It was so close, we could have. It could have really gone down the drain. But we really were blessed. And he did retire, and we came back to Huntington. And I don't know what I'm going to do. My Al-Anon group was my lifeline. They were my security blanket. I was hanging on. They were keeping me going. And I just didn't know how I was going to make it with leaving them behind. But, you know, they told me they thought they had Al-Anon in West Virginia, that not to worry. So when I got back to Huntington, that's when I discovered that Al-Anon is worldwide, and the unity of our program makes it so that we can go into a group. I don't care where we're in, Huntington, West Virginia, or London, England, or Zaragoza, Spain, doesn't make any difference. We're still going to feel at home. We follow the same traditions, and the unity is there. And the group here in Huntington just picked up where my Maryland group had just left off. You know, things were a little bit better. Gene was going to meetings, and he still, you know, it was a swinging door. Thank goodness AA does have a swinging door. You can keep going back. But, you know, I was still doing the same things. I was still managing and directing. I was making sure that I had dinner early on meeting nights so he'd be able to get to meetings. And I'd go to open meetings and nudge him, you know, when somebody'd say something that I thought he needed to really pay attention to. I'd moved his big book and his 24-hour book all over the house. It was in the bathroom in the morning. It was beside his table in the evening, you know. I think at that point, God, as I understand him, looked down and thought, I got to really rescue this person. That if there's going to be any chance for recovery for either of them, I'm going to have to find something to get her out of his hair and off his back. And I think this is when God decided that he would use service as a recovery tool for both of us. Service for me, for a recovery tool for both of us. You know, they told me service is just gratitude and action. But you know, at that point, I'm having gratitude. Oh, I guess I was grateful for the alcoholic, but I sure wasn't grateful for the alcoholism. And I wanted self-service. I didn't want service where I reached. I couldn't reach out. I was still too inward, constricted by the disease of alcoholism to recognize that I could reach out to somebody else. But through the help of a loving group and a loving sponsor, I was kind of gently drawn into service at the group level. I was made aware of the responsibilities and duties necessary to just have meetings. You know, somebody's got to make the coffee and put the literature out, and you got to clean up after a meeting. You got to empty those coffee cups and clean out those ashtrays. I used to dirty enough of them. So I started getting involved a little bit that way. And, you know, it's real spiritual growth when you can get past your own anguish and reach out to somebody else. And I was doing a little of this. I was talking to some of the newcomers that came in, and I agreed to put my name on the answering service list, and I talked to people on the phone when they called and said they had problems. And all of this was starting to help me grow. I was beginning to feel better about me, to appreciate myself as a person. And I think I was beginning to find out that life was going to be better for me. I was really taking care of me more now. I think at this time I was first introduced to structure, Al-Anon group structure. Just Al-Anon world service structure. Gene was invited to go to an assembly meeting in Parkersburg by his sponsor, and naturally I tagged along. And when I got there, I was told that Al-Anon's went upstairs. And I went upstairs, and one of the groups in Huntington didn't have a representative, group representative there, and they told me that I could be the alternate for that group, and I could vote for the group. Gosh, I thought this was great. I was a part of something again. Didn't have the slightest idea what, but I felt real good about being a part of something. And I saw something in those people, just like at my first meeting, that really attracted me. They told me those people were winners, and I'd heard, you know, stick with the winners. And I went home filled with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of curiosity. And we had just recently started that little Wednesday morning group, so I volunteered myself to be the group representative for that little group. Of course, didn't have any competition, so I was elected. And from then on, I was in service. I needed to learn a lot about service. I needed to read the service manuals. I needed to study the traditions and the concepts. And in doing this, you know, I found out that the traditions and the concepts apply not only in Al-Anon work, but they apply in your own personal life. The unity that you need in your family, the concepts to find authority and responsibility and lead to harmony in family relationships. So all of these things were helping me grow. About a year and a half after I had become a GR, I found at the next couple of assemblies that I went to, that I was elected area chairman. Now, this really was a shock because I didn't know anything that I was supposed to do as area chairman. But my sponsor had always told me, Alice, don't ever say to no, never say no to anything that you're asked to do. Try to do it. So after I was elected, I remember calling Evelyn to tell her what had happened, look what this had led to. And she said, oh, Alice, this is great. I'm so proud of you. You know, gave me all the strokes and so forth. And then she said, you know, you're going to be so busy, you're not going to have time to run Gene's life. My ego trip terminated right then and there. I did get real involved, and we had a great 3 years as an area chairman. I think the area and I both grew. And by the time I finished that 3 years, I was kind of tired, and I thought I needed a rest. So I decided I'd step back in the spirit of rotation and sit on the sidelines and cheer for the area. I did. And you know, this was kind of a mistake. I got comfortable. I got complacent. My own life just wasn't nearly as challenging and interesting. In fact, I kind of got despondent about it all. So the next time when we had the next 3 years when the election time came up, I was approached and asked if I would consider allowing my name to stand for a delegate. I had mixed feelings about this. Sure, I'd love the excitement of going to New York and seeing Al-Anon at the World Service level, seeing group conscience in action. But you know, I wondered if I really would be capable of doing a good job. The old insecurities kind of came back. You know, would I be able to go up there and even understand what they were talking about, let alone bring it all back to my area and explain it to my area? I talked to my family about it because I knew I'd need their cooperation if I was going to take on a 3-year job like this. And, you know, both of them, Jean and Mary Kay Patty, of course, by this time was married, both of them said, do what you want to do. We'll be glad to cooperate. They didn't tell me what to do. I prayed about it, and I finally said, God, either bless it or block it. If I'm supposed to do it, fine. If I'm not, that's fine, too. So I went into the assembly for the election, and I thought, whatever happens is God's will. It must have been his will because I was elected delegate. But believe me, I took him with me to all three conferences, and together he and I survived real well. And I have to tell you, people, that was a mountaintop experience. It's something that I'll treasure. I wish every one of you could have that experience. You know, with so many people sharing so much love and experience and strength and hope with you, you just can't help but grow spiritually. It was just something that I will always treasure for the rest of my life. I think really and truly, service has been my salvation. Jerry was saying last night in his lead, he was talking about the why me's. You know, I used to, why me, God? Why have you dumped all of this on me? What did I ever do that I deserve to live with an alcoholic? And you know, I'm still saying, why me? I'm saying, why did I come into Al-Anon and be able to grab hold of the program and stick with it? You know, we see so many people who come to the doors of Al-Anon and hang around for a month or two and then disappear, and you never see them. And I wondered what the difference was. Why me? Why have I been able to stay? And I really think it's been the fact that I got active and involved in service. That has provided the answer. It was no special blessing. I don't think God blessed me any more than anybody else. but I think that it was the involvement and the action and service that made it all possible. I think God did give me life, no doubt about it, but the Al-Anon program and people just like you sitting around these tables have shown me and taught me how to make that life worthwhile. And what was once probably the greatest tragedy in my life has truly turned out to be my greatest blessing. God love you all, and thank you for your help.